You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Hello, friends. Today, I'm going to introduce you to my new friend, Deborah Horwitz. And as a little bit of prep for this conversation, I encourage you to think about something that is sort of like the peak or the high point that you are working towards, or that you maybe want to work towards, and just kind of hold on to that idea because that'll make this more fun. And I want to share something else. So I'm a talker. You probably know that. That's what I do. And on my own, I'm a fast talker, pretty fast talker. I'm actually constantly working on slowing down my pacing for recording and public speaking. My guest in this episode, she is also a talker. And there is one thing I think I can promise you about this conversation, and that is you are not likely to need to want to speed it up to 1.5 or 1.75 speed. That is my prediction. Are you ready? Let's go. Deborah Horwitz, welcome to Imperfect Adulting.
What's up? Happy to be here, Amy.
I'm so glad you're here. Are you ready for a fun chat?
Absolutely.
You were totally fine.
I really want to say no because you said nobody says no. So I'm like, let's get something going here.
What am I? I have to have a plan for when somebody says no. I'll say, okay, all done. No. I like to start every single interview that I do by asking people what part of the world they're in. So share with us where you are.
I am currently in Playa del Rey, sunny Playa del Rey in California, just south of the marina. I'm looking at the boats in the water. The beach is right over there. I do love where I live now.
Oh, I love that part of the West Coast. I do. I only get to go there on vacation, but it's fantastic. So one more gentle warm-up question before we dive into the deep things. I like to give people a chance to get to know you and talk about your personal development, like outside of work, outside of your job. Tell us like something about you. Maybe it's the people you live with, the important people in your life, your hobbies, the pets you have, whatever you want to share.
Got it. Okay. Gosh, let's see. I currently live alone. I was married for a long time. My family of origin is scattered all over the place. My husband, in the process of being ex-husband, is a beautiful person and he's family and always will be. We do not have kids. I had cats for a long time. I don't. I am currently exploring the world of actually being a fully sovereign woman.
And that
is a new place for me to be in my life. And it's way better than I ever thought it could be. I was so worried about being single again. And especially at, you know, my ripe old age, which I'm not going to share right here, but you know, I'm a total middle-aged woman. And I was freaked out for years about the idea of ever being single again. And I'm here to recommend it.
Recommend it. Do you have a nickname? What is the code that you use for who will be your ex? Do you call them your soon to be ex? One of my favorites is the husband, the soon to be husband.
I've heard. Yeah. I mean, we've been, well, this is just much more personal than I intended to be, but okay, fine. we've been stably separated for some time now. And so, and we live about a mile away from each other. So at this point it's kind of like, you know, the paperwork of making things more final. So I've just been calling him my husband for 18 years and I'll figure it out once we're no longer legally married, what to call him.
Got it. No, absolutely. So that's actually not the change that we have on the agenda for today.
Yeah.
What we're going to talk about is walking away from a career when it was at a peak. And I got to say that what you put on your form sounds like kind of what most people would consider an amazing job. Because you were directing a Cirque du Soleil show. Does that sound like something you want to talk about today?
Music directing, not directing.
Music directing, okay.
Yeah. I want to paint an accurate picture. And I absolutely looked like I was walking away from a career at its peak. The problem was it wasn't that. I had been spending the 30, 35 years before that, if you include when I first started performing professionally at 7 years old, and when I first started working as a coach, teacher, leader at 14 years old, I had been working and building a career and a resume for all of those years without ever feeling satisfied, fulfilled, or safe even. Feast or famine existence, always you're only as good as your last gig. What's your next gig? 99 failures for every success, right? So I was like clambering up the hill as, is so imperfectly and messily, but working very hard to make it all look really good on the outside. So, and it's funny, it's interesting to me that you say that you framed it the way you just did, because in my effort to paint an accurate picture to you, I thought I was being quite disclosing about how there were these, failures and things falling apart, and then out of the rubble, Phoenix rising, right? That sort of thing. And even you were like, walked away from a career at its peak. Like, so yes, what I walked away from was the exhaustion and depletion of pretending 24/7 that everything was great. That's what I
Very
walked
cool. All right. So we're going to talk more about that in a second. But first, I want to go back to you as a 7-year-old. I want to unpack the path that got you there, right? Because it wasn't something, this was not your first job out of high school or college, right? So
No, this
you
was
had been
supposed to be the culmination. This was supposed
supposed
to
to
bring
be,
it on home.
exactly. And many of us live our lives, right, with the, or at least we start with the idea that we're going to pick something in high school or in college, and we're going to do that thing forever, and we're going to love it always. And there's always, rainbows and unicorns and puppy dogs, and nothing will ever
Rainbows
go
and
wrong.
unicorns.
That's right. So you did this for what? So let's talk about it at the very, very beginning, like when you were younger. How did you start this journey? Like, what was the beginning, and what called you to it, and what did you love about it?
Thank you. I call music my second language after English, and it was an early strong love that started with a cheap little electric organ in the basement that was like a Hanukkah present, and me flunking out songs I had learned in Hebrew school with these little buttons that made these cheesy sounding chords. And, I didn't have any music education at all. I'm 5, 6 years old, 7 years old, and writing, taking dictation on the notes were labeled 1, 1+, 2, 2+. Like I loved singing. I loved this whole world of music, of capturing these nonverbal emotional expressions, melodies I loved, words I loved, and moving into this space of, oh, this is a thing. This music thing is a thing. My parents bought a $30 garage sale piano. I was a little girl in England. I was born in England. My parents are American. My dad was working for the American government in England. So I was a little English girl until I was 10, and then I became a little Jersey girl, and it was a weird mix that
The
and then I
weirdness.
became a New Yorker right after college, and that is what I call a hometown because I was there for 25 years. But yeah, I found my way into music kind of one step at a time through a toy and then through an old piano. And then I started taking lessons when I was 7. And very quickly, the lessons got me to a place where I was passing London Royal Academy exams for 4th-year studies after like 18 months. I was doing these recitals. Like I moved very quickly through different kind of ranks of just amateur or piano playing. And it was along the timeline of me also becoming what I now call not a clinical definition, but perfectionist, right? And I serve perfectionists now, and I know we'll get to that later, but there it was always with me. The combination of this pure love and passion and desire and attraction, right, to music, this love affair with music was always inextricably intertwined with accomplishing, achieving, winning, markers of
Getting the
success,
score,
metrics of
yeah.
success.
Yeah.
So it was always there, even from the very beginning. I loved it, and I needed to do stuff with it, right, and win and succeed.
So then the first thing, always very inspired. I'm always very curious. Sorry. It's very curious about people who are creatives if they know what was the first exposure they had that called to them, right? Because, it's pretty rare that we choose a creative path without coming into contact with it at some point. And so it sounds like yours was faith-based music, holiday music.
Not holiday, Jewish. So,
Jewish, so like Jewish, so
I
like
was
a
getting, I mean, at that point, you were getting some music in schools. Sadly, they've really
okay.
decimated those programs in public
Yeah.
schools. But yeah, I went to Hebrew school. I was bat mitzvahed. I was I call myself the nice Jewish atheist from New York. So yeah, I had a substantial Hebrew education, Jewish education, alongside my secular public school education, and the music mostly lived in the Judaism. So it's not
So
that
it's
my
not,
I have
yeah.
a completely observant, devout wing of my family now, but we didn't grow up religious per se. We just grew up with like a cultural identity of being Jewish Americans
Yeah,
that had
but in
food
the
and music in
temple
the
and
family.
in the events, hearing the songs, it's like something that brings joy, like it's like a
Yeah, so I
captivating
love the
event. Yeah.
music, and I had this musical toy that I found out
Yeah.
I could bring the music to. That was the beginning. And then I, you know, we live in a world that is absolutely saturated with music, right? So
Right.
I fell in love with pop music. I was super into 80s pop, you know, and like those big textured sounds and all the electronics. I got fascinated with technology early on. Like the first multi-track recording I made was literally my piano teacher's living room, where she had these two giant, gorgeous grand pianos with two cassette recorders. Now y'all know how
Yes.
old I am. There are people who are listening to this who do not even know what a cassette is. Go Google it, right? But
Yeah.
two cassette recorders, like where you would press record play, right? And I pressed record play and played and sang. And then I took that tape recorder and pressed play and then pressed record on the other one and played along to the recording. And I went back and forth on that three or four times until honestly, like the noise
The
floor was
static,
so
yeah.
high, it was just static with like a little bit of sound. That was my first multi-track recording. I did that when I was like 14, 15.
So
And then,
totally unrelated segue. One of my kids several years ago made we at the time, I don't we so I live in Florida, which is hurricane country. So we have like an
lovely.
old-fashioned battery-powered radio that we hold on to for when the power goes out. And it's got the it has the two cassettes, so you can do a mixtape. And so one of my kids made their hopeful girlfriend a mixtape as a present, right? And gave it to this other person. And what was fun about this was that
She had no idea what to do with
the mom called me, is like, we have to go and buy a tape player so that he can like so that they
That's
can like listen to
hilarious.
this. Like, but they were super impressed by the effort that like went into it because this was definitely already in the time of iPods. And so it was like hilarious. But I never did that, but I do remember I'm also old enough to have cassette recordings. I interviewed somebody the other day that still has all their cassettes from that time, but I actually went through and got rid of all that stuff when I did a move at one point. Like it was like sell everything and
There
go.
are cassettes. I have all my cassettes because there's original stuff on cassettes that isn't anywhere else. I still have to
Yeah.
digitize much.
Yeah, no. I like
Right?
yeah, so that is I'm impressed by that. I have repurchased it many, many times, including like when we got a new record player, like, and I had to rebuy albums, and I was as I'm rebuying albums that I'd owned before, I was like, this is so much more expensive than it used to be. So, all right,
Okay.
so that's a really wonderful story. And so then as a kid, you take this very achievement-oriented path. You mentioned the scorings and the competitions with piano, which is a whole thing. And what point did you get into performing and theater and entertainment?
So,
Or
well,
music and
performing was from the
entertainment?
very beginning as
Okay.
a concert pianist, but where I went into more collaborative arts like musical theater, albums, artist bands, that kind of thing was in college when I fell in love with the recording studio, real gear. And
Right.
I fell in love with production magic. At the same time, what's most available in high school and college is theater. And I came out of a high school that was and had an extreme, it was a public high school, giant public high school. I was valedictorian of my class of 800 people. The class
In
was
New
like,
York, what part of New York?
no, in Cherry Hill, New Jersey.
Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Okay.
It's Philadelphia based. When we moved back from England,
Yeah.
we moved to Cherry Hill
Okay.
outside of Philadelphia. Then I moved to
I
New
don't
York.
know any of the schools there, so I can't guess.
No problem. Cherry Hill East, if it matters. But yeah, so they had a huge theater department. They did a tour every fall. They did a gigantic musical in the spring with like 100 people in the cast. Like it was a very big performing. We had competition, wind ensembles, dance companies, very beautifully organized and managed performing arts. And so I was in all of these groups, piano player, singer, even writer, arranger for my The Bells of East, which was, I haven't talked about this in so long, this all girl small group, like a cappella groups, which is what I then went into at Princeton. And but we accompanied ourselves on English handbells, and
Oh
it
my
was
goodness.
gorgeous. I
Love
arranged
it. I love it.
Parsley, Sage, Rosemary, and Thyme. I arranged a Scarborough Fair, Simon
Very
and Garfunkel
nice.
Scarborough Fair, with a preamble in the style of Leonard Bernstein's Chichester Psalms, which I had fallen in love with in the choral groups, which is like this kind of modern day, well, not modern anymore, but late 20th century semi-dissonant kind. I mean, it was like I was so nerding out at 16 years old
It's the
on
time to
this.
do it.
And I was, yeah, and I loved it. It was beautiful. And I will never forget, this was actually the moment that I knew there was something so extraordinary and inspiring and powerful that I was in this group performing this piece alongside my girls and hearing this music come out of us, our voices and bells, and having this audience in front of us. And I had put those notes in front of them. I had given them this, I didn't write the song, obviously, but I had given them this music to do, to perform. And I was hearing it. I was hearing what had been in my head and then on the page, and I was hearing it, and the audience was hearing it, and I made that. And it was like, oh my God, this is like I could have passed out from joy in that moment. And I was hooked. I was like, that we're making music. That's what we're doing. And so that was the beginning of high school. And then in college, I got into the electronics, the recording studios. It was the heyday of synthesizers. So piano players, keyboard players were going nuts with production. I fell in love with commercial music specifically. Specifically, like literally commercials, like car commercials. I wanted like the commercials had the sexiest music in the 90s. That's what I wanted to make. I burst out of college and I arranged like 40 songs for my a cappella group and wrote songs for them, and that they're still on albums and they still do shows. Like I go back to Princeton reunions, which is a big thing, and this group is singing songs I wrote, you know, decades ago, and
Wow.
still fresh. And it's really that's all that's very gratifying. But anyway, I came to New York and immediately pounded the pavements for gigs with commercial houses. I was an intern. I was emptying ashtrays and ordering lunch and fetching this, that, and the other. And then I was getting to be in those studios after hours. And there were days that I just didn't go home. I was like, I had some apartment in Rutgers, New Jersey, and I would, you know, crash on a couch and then go to the other house the next day. And like, I remember the first time after a few months of just work, 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 crash, work, 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 crash, that I had actually the whole night off after 6 p.m. until 9 a.m. the next day. And I felt like I had this abundance of riches. I just didn't even know what to do with myself. I had so much time before I needed to be back at some job somewhere. So I
Yeah.
did that for like a year because when you're 22, you can just do that for a long
Right.
time.
Well, we would call that the hustle now, right? We would call that
Right. So I
hustling to get,
hustled, hustled, hustled. And it was exciting and inspiring and fun for the first 5 or 10 years. You know, and I started to climb up through the ranks, right? So I played my first Broadway show when I was 23. I had my first national commercial on the air when I was 24, 23, 24. I was conducting orchestras and recording studios. I was hustling. And when I say I played my first Broadway show, I wasn't given the gig. I was a sub. Like lots of people make a living in New York by subbing into these regular shows or gigs or things like that and just catch as catch can. So I was cobbling it together and I learned to become, you know, a Jill of all trades so that I could make a living, right? So I learned how to do synth programming. I learned how to do arranging and music directing. I learned how to do lots of different kinds of music production. Oh, what's on the top 10 this week? I'll learn how to make it sound like that, right? And I just became this chameleon, but it was at the cost of me developing my own voice. And I didn't get it at the time because I had always been a total prestige whore. I wanted the titles, I wanted the names, right? Like now how everybody wants to be an influencer, they don't know what they want to say or do. They just like want to be famous. And that's a whole other story.
It's a weird thing to want. It's
It's
a
a weird thing to watch, right? But it's
weird
like
thing to watch.
I was in the, you know, 90s and aughts version of that, right? I just wanted to like be hooked up with like the coolest names and the biggest gigs. And I didn't see it at the time. I actually looked down on the people who were like, you know, carting gear around from gig to gig in crappy little bars that stank of stale beer. And I was like, that's so sad. Well, I'm on this tour, or I'm in this big house or
Right.
whatever. But those people, lots of them, stayed the course, stayed with developing their own original voice, and then had breakthroughs as artists, as writers, as creators, in ways that I didn't because I was always, you know, the second banana, the girl in the band, the background singer, whatever it was, right? And so
Yep.
I would say there was a life lesson there that it took me much too long to learn that. Great, go after the resume building, go after the visibility, the prominence, the money, the fame, go after whatever you want that excites you, but watch what it's costing you in terms of your own expression and
You
you're
think you
all.
could have seen that at the time? This is a question I ask people a lot,
Yeah.
you know,
Could I
like,
have seen that at the time?
because it's easy, you know, we say hindsight is 20/20, and over the
Here's
passage
how
of
I,
time, right? Like, we
yeah,
learn a
of course.
lot. We
Here's how
learn
I
a
could
lot.
have heard it. Here's how I could have heard it. I certainly could not have been told that I should, you know, give up some sort of prestigious thing to do something that I saw as grimy or unworthy. I could not have
Okay.
been told that. But I could have been told, you're trying to shortcut something you can't shortcut. And what you're generating for yourself will get you more of the same forever. It's not a lateral move to going from being on that stage with the famous person to being on your own stage. It doesn't
Right.
work that way.
It's not the progression to do somebody to promote somebody else's art and then have people know that you also make art. Like, those are not the same things always.
Well, you're correct, but that's
Right.
not what I'm talking about. When I see somebody else's stage, like I was making art too. I was just the background singer, not the lead singer.
Right.
I was the arranger, not the composer. I was the, you know, conductor, not the concert mistress. Like it was like I was in a supporting role, not a starring role.
Okay.
I was in a facilitating role, not a creating role. So I was
Right.
still in the artist camp. I wasn't the marketer, the promoter. I did that too. My first and only day job was as an account executive at Saatchi & Saatchi Advertising. And I longed to be on the creative side, but I was on the account side. I was a suit, right? And I thought I could make that lateral move. And they were like, no.
Right.
Right. So I
Yeah.
learned that lesson too. But then I was fully in the artist side. I just wasn't doing the job I wanted to do.
Okay.
And I thought I could eventually make that leap if I was only staying in the room. But it
Yeah.
turns out, no, that is not the case.
Yeah, it's yeah. So I mean, I think
Or at least
that's
it wasn't the
really
case for me. I do know there are, like Mariah Carey used to be a background singer and then she was her own thing, right?
Oh,
Lots of
fair.
people
Good point. Good
come,
example.
right?
Yeah.
So it can happen, but I wasn't making the moves. I wasn't doing the real work of it. Like I wasn't writing at any
Yeah.
sort of pace to be in the position to be the songwriter, the composer, the creator, producer, boss, whatever. I was hoping for someone to give me the chance so that then I would do it. So I guess
Right.
the lesson that might have landed is make the thing and then take it somewhere as opposed to asking or waiting or wanting someone to hire you to make the thing. And I
Right.
kind of do that now in my business where I will sell the thing first and then make it and create this because I still don't just make the thing. I need to be hired to do it.
I have to, a lot of people teach that, like, sell it before you make it. I am a person who I have to at least have an outline and know what I'm going to make. I'm like, so what is it that I'm going to sell? And so,
I
yeah.
don't need to know what I'm going to make. I need to know how I'm going to help. And then
That's
I
I
go full on
yeah.
that.
I love that about you. I do. All right, so we've talked a lot about, so it's very clear from listening to you that you love music and you love the creation process. And you mentioned a few things that you didn't love about working in the music production industry long term. So, but what are some of the things when we talk about when you're getting ready to make this shift dramatically? What were some of the things specifically about the last production, Cirque du Soleil, that you maybe loved or didn't love? What was coming up right before the change is where I'm going with this.
Yeah, and when you say the change, you mean like into what I'm doing now
Right,
as a
exactly. When it was
coach and
like, all right,
as an entrepreneur. Yeah,
this week
got
I'm
it.
doing, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, there were many things that were extraordinary and specific to Cirque, but I'll speak in kind of the overall like show business space, just because Cirque is so specific. And there was so much that was incredible and exhilarating about working with a company where, as they say, the artistic always comes first. Like with most entertainment, from the biggest, you know, multi-million dollar Hollywood movies, multi-dozens of millions of dollars of Hollywood movies,
The numbers are
to
crazy.
the tiniest little indie theater production off Broadway, where their entire budget is like $10,000 for 3 months or something like that, right? All the entire range of that, you are always dealing with, here's the budget, what can we do, right? And then the vision is inside of the budget. Now people blow budgets all the time, but the concept is, here's the money we're working with, now go do whatever you're going to do with it. Cirque works in the opposite way. Artistic drives, creative drives production. So they go, what crazy idea can we come up with? What amazing spectacle can we create for our audience? Okay, how would we create that? Okay, what will that cost? Here's the check, right? And that was enthralling. That by itself was just like, holy crap, sky's the limit, and we're making these amazing stuff. I mean, they used to have rehearsal calls just to like fly a sweater up 16 stories so that we could see how the light would hit it when the aerialist was up there before they swung down to the, like, I mean, the creative was off the chain.
Oh,
I was
yeah,
a
it's
fan since I
amazing.
was in the early 90s. That gig was a dream come true for me. And working with Danny Elfman, A-list Hollywood film composer, as the composer in his studio every day for 6 months. I mean, all of that was absolutely thrilling. Fully legit, uncompromised thrilling. And it was at the end of a long road where I was already coming in pretty burned out,
Yeah.
pretty depleted, pretty over it, right? Like I Jersey Boys, I did all these hit Broadway shows, Mamma Mia, Miss Saigon, Jersey Boys. I did the original Broadway companies of all those shows as conductor, keyboard player, whatever it was. And like Jersey Boys was my show for like 17 years. I was the music technical designer for that production worldwide and launched about 25 different companies of it. I was the original onstage keyboard and vocals girly who had a few different spots on stage as the whole band did. And I absolutely loved that job and loved the show. I loved the people. I mean, everything about it was wonderful. And not everything. I mean, everything's got its drawbacks. But, you know, it was a glamour gig. It's a kind of gig that every musician in New York wants. And I freaking loved it. And this is an 8-show-a-week grind. And
That's
by the time I was like, you know, show number 2000, at 45, you know, people would be like, "Oh my God, how was the show today?" I'd be like, "How was your fucking day at the office?" I don't know. I didn't even wake up until I got home. Like, and I was super jaded about it.
Yeah.
And I prioritized doing a good job, right? Like, you know, and as we all did, right?
Right.
We'd be off stage, la la la, chit chatter, go on stage, big smiles, right? All the things. But then it'd be like, "Oh, how many more of these before I have a day off?" You know, kind of thing.
Right.
And
It's the job.
it's a job. It
It's a job.
becomes a job, and that's the best case scenario where you
Right.
have financial security and the fame and glamour component, you know, walking out of the stage door and everybody's woo. I mean, not necessarily for me, then, but for the stars of the show, and you know, and just to walk out to like an excited, welcoming throng when you leave your
Right.
office for the day is really fun, right? That stuff is fun, and so there was always this tussle of like how it is on the outside, how it looks out there, how I'm holding up the world, and how I'm gleaning my gratification and trying to have that substitute for real fulfillment and continuing to deplete myself, chasing down some sort of metric of success that would actually last longer than like a hot bath, you know, and
Yeah.
it just became so much, you know, with this pretending. And then also financially, like there were times when I was making really good money for show business. You know, there are a very few, like with sports, right? There are very few in the entertainment industry that really make the millions and millions and millions of
Right.
dollars. I did make millions over many, many years, right? I did make decent money, but it was feast or famine. It was not on my schedule. It was not on my terms. And there were large stretches of time where I made very little or no money. And even when you have those people who are in those higher echelons of lots of zeros, it's lots of zeros coming in and going out. It
Right.
all comes with a ton of pressure. It's all precarious. You're still only as good as your last gig, right? It's a very, very few people that have such extraordinarily established careers. Even, I'll tell you a real quick little story of one of my colleagues was on a plane with an older woman at one point who, and they just got to chit-chatting a little bit, and he talked about how he was a musician and composer or whatever. And she said, "Oh, my daughter's an actress and she's so established, but she just feels like she's like every time a project finishes, she does these movies, but every time a movie finishes, she feels like she's never going to work again." Now, this was in the aughts or maybe late 90s. You know what she was talking about?
No, tell us, tell us.
Streep.
Meryl
Her daughter was Meryl Streep.
Oh.
Meryl Streep was worried she was never going to work again after her last. I mean, if that chick is worried, who the hell
That's amazing. So you mentioned something that I'm going to bring up because I think it's really interesting because you're talking about your motivation and what was driving you, and you were in entertainment and this was live performances. So that's one of the very few times where in your job you get applause at the
is safe?
end of what you do. But
And I
it's
loved it.
right, exactly. It's like a really, really strong carrot. Like the guy who and the guys and the girls who are going to work at accounting firms, they do their work and no one applauds for them at 4:45. For filling in the
Right.
spreadsheets, right?
And that was a
And
very small amount of time a day because remember, I was also concurrently doing production, and there were many, many hours when I was slaving by myself over a keyboard or stressing out over how it wasn't good enough or playing two notes and it's derivative horse shit and I'm never going to write anything good ever again. Very lonely, very isolated. No applause and lots of failure. I submitted so many pieces of music for projects and didn't get the gig. So much failure, so much uncertainty. So there was that too.
And learning to figure out where those cues are going to come from, like, is this good? How do I feel good about yourself? I think probably ties into your journey, like learning for yourself, not like learning in a classroom, like learning for yourself. All right. So you make the decision, or the decision is made for you. This is coming to an end. I'm no longer going to do this. And then was there a time where, so today you're an entrepreneur and we'll talk about that and you do some things. Was there a time where you were like, okay, I'm not going to do Cirque du Soleil, but I'm going to stay in entertainment? Or did you, were you like, and now what I'm going to do is I'm going to search for the stability that one finds in building one's own business? Because that
It was in
is.
pieces. Yeah. And I want to, I think a really, probably the most important point I want to make about this is it was in pieces. It didn't look cute or organized. It was probably about a total of 5 year process from the Cirque show closing and me feeling decimated. Because the show was supposed to run for 10 years and it ran for two, and I had completely upended my life, left Jersey Boys. Like, I knew it was a risk. I just didn't know how badly it was actually going to go. And so, and during that time, I had done like nothing else. You know, any artist has a million irons in the fire, no matter what they're doing. And I had dropped all the irons because Cirque was so all-encompassing. So I was dumped unceremoniously out on my ass in LA, with absolutely no idea how I was going to make a living or what was going to happen next. So I did face a choice point then. Then of what now? But at that point, I had only ever done music professionally, except for that, you know, few months at Saatchi when I was 22 years old. I had been a professional musician for about 25 years at that point, and I had not done anything else professionally. And I was unemployable, intentionally so. I was not going to go out there and get some sort of conventional job. I was the default choice at that point, as it had been with any other gig ending, even the big ones, was I'm gonna start pounding the pavement again. I'm gonna start making calls again. My contacts get better and better over the years. My skills get better and better over the years. My reel gets better and better over the years. And I'm just gonna take it all out into the world again and start talking to people and hustle, hustle, hustle until the next big thing comes along. And I'll hope it's not too long until that happens. That was the default. That's what I did for decades. But at that point, when Cirque was done, I recognized that I was really not okay. Like I was profoundly exhausted in a way I hadn't been before. I was disillusioned in a way I hadn't been before. I was jaded and bitter and pissed off in a way that I hadn't been before. And I found myself unwilling to go back to doing what I had done since I was 22 years old. I was unwilling. I was like, is that all this has added up to? Is I'm just starting from scratch again? Fuck you, universe. Sorry, I don't know if we're cursing on the podcast, but I swear
Totally
to
fine. I am my own production company. I get to make the rules. You can
There
say
you
what you
go.
want.
Beautiful. So the first step for me was realizing I can't just go back and do the same thing again as I always have. Something has got to give. I didn't know what. So I did continue to, I mean, I did what I knew how to do, which was, oh, show's over, let's start talking to people again. So I did that and I did more gigs. I had some cool gigs. Like 2014, I worked with Jason Alexander from Seinfeld on a show
Oh, that's
here
cool.
in LA that was an adorable show. And I got to do a bunch of writing and performing and collaborating with him and some really other wonderful, talented people. And I did an off-Broadway show that I went back to New York and did an off-Broadway show that like won some awards. The New York Times called it one of the top 10 productions of the year, which was so odd
Also
and
cool.
crazy. Like that's a thing in New York City, right? So I had these little bits and pieces. I kept cobbling the resume together. Again, on the outside, I was looking like, yeah, you know, I did all these big productions back to back, Jersey Boys, Cirque. I'm doing some smaller stuff. I'm exploring my artistic leadership, blah, 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 right? It was just PRing my way into don't question what I'm doing. But the first step for me was to heal myself because there was also a ton of personal shit that was going on with my marriage. I failed fertility treatments for 6 years. I was always very ambivalent about motherhood, but felt like I should do everything I can. That's
Oh
its own
wow, that was
podcast, right?
probably
Like, There were
Yeah,
things where
but
it was
that was
all
probably a roller coaster under
totally
the.
hormones all over the place. Got, you know, was I was so alienated from my own body. I felt betrayed by everything I had held dear in life about how things were supposed to go, what my hard work was supposed to get me. You know, it was like if this gig, this circ gig was the ultimate, it was the culmination of so many things I had worked for. It brought together so many components that you just don't even see together in one lifetime. And I was like, if that didn't work, if that didn't put me into a place where I am, where I want to be, everything has led up until now. It was all worth it. If that didn't get that done, I don't know what will. I don't know if anything will. And that's when I started to go, I went dark first.
I
I
can
was,
hear it in the way you tell the story. Like it is
I went
very, all of the
really,
pieces are there. Physical,
really
mental,
dark.
dreams.
Yeah, I'd been depressed like twice in my life. I'm not prone to depression, but I think I was really profoundly depressed twice in my life. The first time was after I came off of the Cyndi Lauper tour, and I was so
Oh
disoriented
my
from.
God, that's so cool. Sorry.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, so I toured with Cyndi Lauper and Cher, the Do You
Oh
Believe?
my gosh.
Right, so
Okay.
that,
Very good.
that whole thing is
Fangirling for just a second.
what.
Go on. Sorry.
Absolutely. So that's like 25 years ago at this point, but yeah, so that was, it, and again, totally glamorous, totally good looking, super sexy rock star stuff. I'm in, you know, stiletto boots and leather mini skirts in front of 20,000 people in an arena, hearing my name shouted and people screaming. Like that shit was amazing. But I loved that. Like you were talking about the applause thing before. I loved that for, you know, 45 minutes a day. The other 23 hours and 15 minutes, I wanted to throw myself out a window. Right. And then when I got home, I just like, I would wake up and not know what city I was in or where, you know, I'd be confused by my own kitchen because I was like, what hotel am I in that has a kitchen? What's like, you know, like I was not in my right head about it. And a relationship that I was kind of nursing along that was doomed was finally over. Like it was just so, and I needed to relearn how to be in my own life and career and body and all that stuff. And it was the same then about, you know, 12 years later. And so I knew I needed help. I didn't know I needed a new business or a new career. I didn't know what was going to happen professionally. I just knew I needed to feel better in my own body, my own skin. I felt deeply uncomfortable and unsettled and disoriented and lost in my own skin. I didn't know how to be 45 instead of 25. I didn't know how to no longer be the youngest, cutest person in the room or whatever. I didn't know how to do my life at this point with all that had come before now and feel okay. And so that in 2015 was when I did my first like high ticket mentorship. Like I was not in the world of coaching and mentorship at all. I had done a lot of personal growth very early on with Est and Landmark and other sort of
Oh,
intense personal
Landmark,
growth
that's an old name.
programs.
Okay, yeah.
Oh yeah. Right. And Est was 10 years before that. Like when I was a kid, I was a personal growth junkie. So I had been doing that alongside, and I credit that with having me with the success I was able to achieve and the way in which I did stay quite stable, considering how uncertain and unstable my industry was, and managed to save money and do all those sorts of things. I credit that work with that. I learned the power of my word, the power of integrity, the power of intentions, all these types of things. But here I was at this new space where, you know, coaching and mentorship and transformation and all of that had become so much more of a thing by the 20 teens. And there was someone who was a teacher and mentor I had been following already in the relationship space. And she ran a what she called the women's embodiment experience. And it just sounded like everything I needed. It sounded like community and safety and support and understanding and learning and wisdom and clarity and feeling at home in myself and with myself. And I needed that so badly. And I made what at the time was a heart-stopping investment of like $9,000 or $10,000. And I was already in debt. I did not have money coming in. I didn't know what that, I mean, it was nuts to do this. But that one little piece of self-trust, I was otherwise so lacking in self-trust. I was so codependently caretaking everything around me, locating my worth in my resume, all the ways that it was just, I was not centered. I was not in a place of knowing that I was worthy without all the laurels and accomplishments. I did not trust myself to make any sorts of decisions or choices. I was completely dislodged from any sort of safety or clarity. But this I felt in my bones was a call that I needed to heed and not decline, and
And
that I
did it work out?
knew
Was it
what it took.
beneficial?
It was hugely beneficial. It was the beginning of what ultimately became a program and a coach that I worked with in 2017 to learn how to do a summit, which is a business launching mechanism to bring together an audience or a buyer's list, if you will, of people who are interested in solving the problem you're putting out there to solve. And it was like, as we're recording this, I'm doing the
You're
next
doing
one
another one,
now,
yeah.
manual, right? And that became the sea change for me. So from 2012 to 2015 was a lot of mess and a lot of dark and a lot of floundering and a lot of pretending. 2015 was the beginning of me finding home again and locating and grounding myself and starting to trust myself. And then 2017 was, and I there were many false starts, and it's still messy and imperfect. Like, I just need to drive that point home, because when I started to become the entrepreneur that I am now in 2017, 18, whatever, I was seeing all these stories that just felt so pat and cliche and impossible to role model, which was everything was great or everything was terrible, but at some point there's a fall, right? There's a fall, and I had this moment, and then I got ding the idea, or ding the solution, or ding whatever it is I'm selling you now, and now everything is amazing and I never have a bad day. Fuck right off, honestly. Like, not work that way.
I
It
have
does not work that way.
it very rarely works that way. And when I hear that now these days, I think I have two thoughts. One is the person who's saying that does not actually know what they did that worked to get them to where it is. So then they
Good
can't
point.
share it with you, right? Or,
Good
which is
point.
fine. There are things I do all the time that work that I'm like, I have no idea what worked, because you're always doing 10 things at one time. And then you look back and you're like, was it this or was it that?
Exactly.
No way to know.
Right.
And so that's one possibility. And then the other one is that there it's hard to tell between something that is legit and like, this is security and this is safety and this is community and these are tools, and those are the magic pieces of transformation, right? They really are like clarity and
Absolutely.
security and self-worth. That's magic. But two of the same people can say that, and one person can really be genuine and effective or just be a good connection, and another person cannot be.
Right.
It's
Person
hard to
can
tell the
just
difference,
be
right?
working aligned to a sale.
Right,
Absolutely.
exactly. It's
Absolutely.
very hard to tell from the outside.
I wanted to, and 100% true. And that was one of those were the sharky waters that I was like moving through and navigating when I was choosing what to do, how to do it, because I needed something of substance, right? And I saw, like, on the one hand, there were these like super sharky guru guys, mostly dudes, I'm sorry, but they were mostly dudes, like, the beach house and the Lamborghini, and this is the lifestyle, and then what it was like a real estate thing or whatever the fuck, like, here's how you're gonna get rich in 10 minutes, and and just buy my thing, and I was like that, and guys selling like, here's how to do a webinar that'll sell webinars on people who are making webinars to, I mean, it was just like the sort of kind of MLM-ish vibe of, you're gonna create a thing that you're gonna sell, but what you're selling is how to make the thing that you just made. So it's kind of circular. What are you actually making? What substance are you creating? What are you offering? And that stuff just all landed with me as very false and more pretense that I didn't want. And then there were like the super sincere, wonderful people, the healers, the yoginis, and they seem to be quite genuine, but they either weren't making any money or they were like spiritual bypassing their asses off. And I didn't know what that term was at the time, but they're like underneath the la la la, everything is peaceful, was seething rage and an inability to process any negative emotion whatsoever. I'm like, I'm so sorry, but I do not respect your level of development.
That is so funny. All right, so we could talk about this forever, but I promised you before
Okay.
we started that we would
Yes.
hit the
Bringing it in.
time limit, and
Yes.
I don't want that to be a lie. All right, so you have this amazing resume, and you're in the spot where you're doing the self-work, and you know you're making changes, and you're going through
Yes.
all this stuff, and that's a beautiful way to do it, although it was probably scary because you were very highly achieved and you'd done a lot. It is really, I think, very hard for people to be like, I'm here. How do I start over? And you had like life stuff going on. So what did you finally land on? What do you do? Tell people what it is that you do today and all the good things.
Thank you. So I decided to trust this particular program and process and coach and hand over the reins in the sense, right? So for the rest of the world, 2017 to 2020, I was still a full-time musician. I was still the person with that resume. I didn't change my LinkedIn profile or anything like that. You could not find me as a coach online until I was about 3 years into my coaching business. It was a $250,000 business. I had already run a bunch of summits. I already had groups that were successful, private clients that were paying me a bunch of money. Like, so I just want to really make the point for, especially for my kindred perfectionists, right? A website doesn't make you a business. A brand doesn't make you a business. What makes you a business is when you sell products and services, and that's it. And so what I was doing was I was learning how to really refine and monetize this business model of what I then learned was affiliate email marketing and making summits, running these partnership events, bringing, cross-pollinating my people, their people, and doing what I felt was a very generous, very non-show business model of let's just hand over a bunch of assets and resources and trust that our people will find who they need to find. And little by little, each year I created something new. I started my first group program in 2018. I launched my first course in 2019. I rolled out Cobalt Coaching, which is my company, in 2020. And at once, so it, to the rest of the world, it looked like one day I was composer music director, and the next day I was productivity coach for perfectionists with all of this credibility. I waited until I had comparable, not it wasn't going to be the equivalent of 25 years in show business, but somehow comparable credibility as a coach before I moved my public persona over to that. And now I'm very satisfied with that, and I've been building the brand and the company for the last 5 years in that way. But when I was, and people were like, how do you sell a program without a website? Here's how: you get on the phone, you do things that bring people forward to where they're raising hand and saying, I would like help, right? And like doing podcast interviews like this. And then when I get on the call with them, and I was trained really well by someone who is a fucking monster with sales and marketing, and I made sure I had my authentic heart in it because I know what it's like when you don't, and it is soul sucking. And I will never do that shit again. So I always believe in what I'm selling. And I always love that I believe in what I'm selling, and that's what makes it work. Along with really important, as you said, it's tools, all the rest of that. I don't think that security is one of the magic tools. I think you actually have to be willing to give up certain kinds of security, not necessarily financial, right? Not necessarily put yourself in some sort of precarious position where your survival instincts are on high alert,
That was the
but
security that I was talking about.
like yes,
That's the
have.
one.
Right. Yeah. Make sure that you've got, food on the table and a roof over your head so that you can start to take some of those emotional and spiritual risks that will get you somewhere you haven't been before, by all means. But yeah, so it was like, and I would get on the phone and they'd be like, can I find something about this online? I'm like, no, this is invitation only. You find out on a call with me. And that's how I filled a group program for 2 years and built it to $1 million program,
It's amazing. That's
And so
amazing.
yeah,
And
so
so
that's
cobalt
I'm a
training.
productivity coach for perfectionists.
Okay.
Productivity for Perfectionists was my very first summit title in 2017. I'm doing my ninth annual this spring and counting. I hit the mother lode with that. It was a lucky break, but it was also the result of really digging deep and doing the work on what mattered to me. And it still does.
Fantastic. All right. And so you have a special thing that you're offering to the
Yes.
audience, right? How to get big things done without needing to fix your habits, your mindset, or your impossible schedule. Free
Exactly.
video training, which I gotta tell you, sometimes video training is not that great, but I think that video training by you is probably spectacular based on this conversation. So I like
Thank
really
you.
think that people should do that. And people can find that at howtogetbigthingsdone.com.
That's it. How to get
And
big things done.com.
how to get bigthingsdone.com. And so that's in the show notes. I'll put it in the email that goes to everybody, which is the best way to get it, because then you can just click on it. So everybody should
Yes,
sign up.
please. Yes,
So we're
please.
going to close up
Yes.
with three random questions.
Please.
These are supposed to be rapid fire. I'm not good at rapid fire. You're less good than I don't think that brevity is my strength, but brevity is definitely not your strength. Verbosity is the thing that we have in common, okay? But we're going to do our best here, all right?
So what is this, like a 10-second answer, a 30-second
It,
answer?
it there is not enough data to have a consistent thing, but we're just going to play it
Quick.
by ear. But we're just
Make it
we're,
quick.
right, exactly. It hasn't worked once, so we'll just do the best we can. Okay. When you travel by plane, are you a person who likes to get to the airport early and have lots of time for stuff to go wrong, or are you one of those people who shows up at the gate right before boarding closes?
I used to be the latter. And as I have become a grown up with lots of perks for flying, I like to get early, go to the lounge,
Go to the
have a
lounge.
coffee, do a thing. So yes, I will build in lounge time as part of my travel experience. So by dint of that, I get to the airport early.
Very good, very good. All right. Do you read books or like audiobooks? And if so, what was the last book you read or listened to?
Oh, I always have 20 books going at once.
Okay.
There is a book called On Repeat that is a scholarly book about the effect of musical repetition on human brains and our relationship culturally and individually to repetition, specifically with music, but with other sorts of sound. That's a dense read, but really interesting. I recently picked up again the novel A Dog's Purpose, which absolutely made me weep right up there with Time Traveler's Wife. And start reading that again, as well as Children of Light, Children of Darkness, Reinhold Niebuhr. Not light reading at all, but I like to go back to the philosophers here and there and read up on what they think is the source, reason, and purpose of humanity. And I've got like a million nonfiction things on Kindle, and I just picked up a total chick lit. I know you're not supposed to say that anymore, but I'm a girl. I can say chick lit. Some chick lit romance, not the pulpy romance stuff, but like some rom-com type of novel. Which I haven't started yet, and I can't remember the title, but it's on the Kindle, and I'm looking forward to digging in.
Very, very cool. All right. Now, third and final. Would you rather be the host of a dinner party or be an invited guest? And then why?
I've been both. I love both. It really depends on the day. As the host, obviously, much more work. I'm a girl who likes to run the room. I've run the room professionally for many years. I dig running the room. In fact, I hosted a night before Thanksgiving party that was epic and I loved it and it was great. And of course, you get to have who you want there, serve what you want to serve, all that
That's
kind of
right.
stuff. But there's all the pressure of it's all on you. And when you're hosting, your mind is not fully in the participating. That was, a downside of, right? It's like you always have one eye towards whatever, the kitchen or what plate needs to be cleared or whatever. So I absolutely also love being a guest and just being treated. I would say if I had to choose one forever, I would host because I can't not run the room indefinitely. But I like both.
Very cool. That's it, Deborah Hartz. You've been a
How'd I do
fantastic
with the
guest.
concision? Come on.
You know, I'm going to give you a 7 out of 10. 7 out of 10. I like it's like
My
it
little
was good.
perfectionist heart just cracked into a million
Now
pieces
it was
before.
great. You were fantastic. You were absolutely fantastic. And I too cannot release the control of hosting the dinner party because I really like to plan the menu.
Oh,
I'm
yes,
fine
there
with
you
somebody else, you know, serving me the food, but I like to know what's. I like to pick the things that are going to be on my plate. All right, there we
Those
go.
are fun questions, Amy. Thank you.
Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obvi again, please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself. Head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adult to your adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting Podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.